I'm holding in my hands a book called Jokes My Father Never Taught Me. On the cover is a picture of the legendary comedian Richard Pryor, and on his shoulders, the cutest little girl in the world. Her name was Rain Pryor.
Yes.
Not was in the past tense, still is.
I've changed it.
Rain is here in St. Louis to talk about the book and do a book signing tonight at the St. Louis Public Library on Olive tonight. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you in here. Holy cow, what a life you've had.
Right.
Before we talk about your life, though, I want to talk a little bit about a controversy that is somehow connected to your dad, and that is the recent controversy about the N-word.
That just makes me laugh, period. You know, I mean, I understand the controversy of it, but I really think, you know, I think it's kind of funny that there's a controversy over the N-word when, you know, months ago there was, you know, what's his face? Who's the other actor that
Mel Gibson?
Racist?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, Mel Gibson. Yeah.
Yeah. Use the J word.
Use the J word, and, you know, we didn't make too much of a fuss about it. I think what we have to do is look in context of history of why that word is so painful and then work from there. And decide how it's used, why we're using it in the first place. Are we using it to educate? Are we using it to demean somebody? And I think Michael Richard needs to do some therapy on his self-hatred and hatred of others.
Your dad, famously in the early 70s, in one of the all-time great stand-up movies, Live on the Sunset Strip, talked about having gone to Africa, coming back, and deciding he would never use that word again.
Right, right.
And recently, Paul Mooney, who I'm sure you know,
wrote
for your dad for a long, long time.
Right.
He said that he's changed his position, and he's used that word a lot in his life.
Yes, he has.
If anybody's ever used that word...
If anyone should stop using it, might be Paul Mooney.
I think he's pretty much drawn everything he can from it. But he may be the only person who's ever used that word more than your father did.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
And wrote jokes for your father with that word in it and all that sort of stuff. But he now says that he is going to stop using that word.
Right.
Do you think, as a person who grew up half black and half Jewish... So you're connected to both the Mel Gibson and the Michael Richards stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel torn.
Yeah. No. Do you think there's any value in people stepping forward and saying, let's not use that word at all, no matter what our skin color is?
I really think that the value, again, it goes back to, I think the value is an understanding historically about the word and why it's so offensive in the first place and why someone would go to a place of anger like Michael Richards did that brings it up, that has the impact that it does. I think that's more important than just saying, I'm going to stop using a word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think just saying that doesn't really make a statement as it is to make more of a historical statement.
Okay. Let's leave the subject alone right there.
Yeah.
We'll just leave it there.
Sorry. Yeah.
Now let's talk about your rather amazing life and your life with your dad, because that's what the book is about.
Yes.
You call your dad in the book a self-destructive, self-absorbed schmuck.
That sounds about Pryor, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. His whole life?
I think there were moments that he was like that. I mean, I don't think you can be Richard Pryor and not be self-absorbed and a schmuck at the same time. I think that's what made him so vulnerable to people was that, one, and such a great performer, I think there has to be a huge sense of narcissism, and my dad definitely had that. And out of his tragic life came a bunch of comedy. So I think, you know, that kind of balances itself out. But then on the other hand, he was also could be warm and fuzzy and adorable and a great dad at the same, you know, and not be a great dad. I think it's a juxtaposition.
It's funny to hear you calling him a great dad because of the experiences you had with him that would not be classified as great by any means.
But he's only a dad I had. I didn't have someone else's dad where I can say, oh, well, he was really, really terrible and I should never have loved him or sought after his love. I think, you know, from how I grew up, he was the only man that existed in my life and the first man I laid eyes on that I fell in love with. So I think from that, accepting him for who he is helps to make it a lot easier. And the good times were the good times, and the bad times weren't the bad times. And I'm not afraid to face that and say they sucked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah.
When you met your dad, you were 4 years
old.
There's a famous story, and you tell it in the book about you going to a pool party, your mom kind of dragging you there and saying, come on, you're going to meet your dad.
Yeah.
And going to this pool party, and there are lots of women around.
Oh, always. There was always lots of women. You know, most of them were hookers, but yeah, there was lots of women.
Most of them were hookers because he grew up in a whorehouse.
Absolutely. And grandmother ran the whorehouse. So, you know, mama was there too with her, you know, women in tow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and dad loved that. I mean, it made him feel comfortable.
What was his relationship like with women? Stormy, would that be a good word for
it? That's a very nice word. Yeah, Stormy combined with a little OJ. Yeah, I think that'll work.
Oh, wow, man.
And you're not kidding because there was a lot of abuse there.
Yeah, I'm not kidding. But, you know, my dad was very abusive, very much misogynistic towards women, and it was a shame. But then also, again, could be the very charismatic and loving and, you know, the kind of person, yeah, you did want to settle down and be with.
Did all these women who were part of his life, and he was married...
They were all crazy, yes.
Including your mom?
Including my mother, yes.
He was married 7 times to 5 different women and had a total of 7 children, right?
Yeah, six times to 5 different women.
Okay. Yes. And total of 7 children that you know of.
Yes, that I know of, yes.
Yeah. Are those former members of Richard Pryor's family, and I guess still members of his family,
right,
even though he's not
around anymore.
Are they close to each other? Are the women who are married to him?
No, the women actually aren't close. None of them are close to each other. It's really the kids that we're all close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we're close to the women, but the women aren't, you know, they don't hang out like they used to back in the day.
Did they hang out together?
Yeah, you know, sometimes, yeah. My dad would sort of like to orchestrate that to see what drama would ensue, you know?
Really?
Yes, let's talk about your child and what she'll be getting, and then let's talk about your child and what she's not getting and what she should be getting, you know. And it was like, he loved that. He loved drama and chaos.
Mm-hmm.
He loved the circus.
You mentioned in the book that your dad gave you an Afro wig and a Mr. Microphone,
right,
and gave one of your sisters a trust fund.
We joke about that. My sister hates that. Really, what happened?
I can't imagine why.
She really, what happened was I got the rainbow colored Afro wig, Mr. Microphone, and she ended up getting Shakespeare books because I was going to be the performer and she was going to be the student, good mm-hmm. and beautiful. So. Yeah.
Were you going to be the performer because your mom and dad wanted you to be the performer, or they couldn't stop you from being a performer?
I don't think they could have stopped me either way. You know, I think I was definitely one of those that I came out of the womb wanting to perform and be that. And being the middle child, I mean, you know, any psychologist will tell you it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was the definite clown. You know, perform to make you happy.
Like me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Talking to Rain Pryor, her new book is called Jokes My Father Never Taught Me, about her life, love, loss with Richard Pryor. She'll be signing copies of it tonight at the St. Louis Public Library on Olive. This is News Talk 1120 KMOX. Your life with your dad was complex.
Yes.
But at what part wasn't he your dad? He was the famous guy, Richard Pryor.
That's interesting. I think I didn't really – well, I guess I sort of did compartmentalize him. Like, there were – I think he was always my dad. When he was on stage, he was Richard Pryor. When he was off stage, but it was always my dad. I don't know how to – yeah, I never really separated the two until I got older. I think other people separated that because they saw him, obviously, the greatest comedian ever.
Mm-hmm.
So he was larger than life always, but I always just assumed my dad was larger than life.
Mm-hmm. Was he already doing stand-up by the time you became aware of who he was?
Absolutely. And I would go see him and watch him, but I remember being 9 years old and seeing him live with 3,000 people and being in awe because I'm like, oh, my God, that's my dad, and everyone's laughing at him,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was an amazing experience.
Were you aware of where he was in the comedy pantheon at that point?
Not at all.
It was just, wow, my dad's funny.
I mean, look, prime example is, you know, here I am, 7 years old, in Paris, France, me, my brother, my sister. My dad takes us to see Silver Streak. It's in French. He comes out afterwards. He asks each one of us who his favorite comedian is. You know, it gets to me, and I'm like, Steve Martin, Daddy, Steve Martin. So, you know.
Let's talk about the movies for a second, because you brought them up. Your dad made some wonderful movies with Gene Wilder, and towards the end, a not-so-wonderful movie with him. And he also, hope you don't mind my saying this, made a heck of a stinker.
Right. Which one?
Made a few stinkers. I was thinking specifically of The Toy.
Yeah, politically, yeah, it's the most incorrect film he could have done.
Yeah.
And can you believe he could have been in Driving Miss Daisy and turned it down?
What?
I didn't know that.
Yes. It's his philosophies. I don't want to drive no white woman around.
But I will play the property of Jackie Gleason.
Play The Toy.
Does that make sense to you?
Doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
No. Now I know he was on something when he made that decision.
Did he talk to you about these career choices?
Never. He just did them, and, you know, off we would either go with him or stay at home.
Wouldn't say to you, oh, man, this movie I'm making, this movie I made and I just saw it, it's absolutely horrible.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Would he give you advice?
You know,
about the business?
Yeah, mainly with it was just.
Don't do movies where you are Jackie Gleason's property. That would be rule number one.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. No, you know, his whole thing was really just about being truthful and being authentic and, you know, not being around, not allowing people to seduce you in that way. You know? So.
But you did grow up knowing at a certain point that here's my dad, not only a comedian, but now a movie star,
et cetera. Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, when you're flying down the Concorde, yes. You know, I mean, you tend to go, not everyone does this.
You didn't look around at your other friends? You grew up in Hollywood, for goodness sake.
You know, but it's funny. I grew up in Hollywood below the tracks with my mom, so I had this very normal hippie-style lifestyle. And then would go to my dad's and it would be the other opposite and extreme. But in school, I didn't hang around like stars, kids, or any of that. I didn't have that. Not at all. Just didn't have that lifestyle.
What was your life like when you were in high school? Did other kids know you as Richard Pryor's daughter?
Yes.
And treat you differently because of that?
Yes. They all thought I would have a party and they could come over and use drugs. Yes. But that, you know.
And?
Never happened. And not in my house. You know, so, yeah, it was wild because people just want to know you because your dad is, you know, who he is. And then you're just like, I just want to be a kid. And you're not – then they would come to my mom's house, and here we would have, like, the shag carpeting and, you know, completely opposite lifestyle. And they were a little, like, you know, miffed at that.
And was part of your childhood also growing up around the hookers?
Yes, it was, especially around my father. I mean, to me, that was normal, though. I mean, definitely. Especially in Beverly Hills, I think most every husband had a hooker somewhere. But, you know, just their wives. But at least in Dad's house, it was, you know, in the open and you saw everything.
Mm-hmm. And what did that do to you as a young girl growing up?
I think what it did for me was I think in some way visually I was over-sexualized. And I think I was very shy and still am shy about my physical appearance and, you know, and somewhat... You know, and I think that's okay. I'm definitely not conservative or prude, and but I have a little kink to me. But however, I will say that
use that line.
I am shy nonetheless. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can mess with your mind.
So, but you didn't look at those and say, "Well, this is what I want to be when I grow up."
Yeah, I want to sell my body. No, I did not. No, I did not.
I asked because there were probably girls who grew up in that exact atmosphere who did.
I'm sure, but it was different. It wasn't like okay, here. Are the hookers and they're paraded around and look at, they're great. I mean, they had their place. They were like, literally, and I don't mean to be disrespectful. They were dogs. They were transactions. That's what we knew them as. That's where they were a lower life form. They were there for one purpose only, and that was it.
Mm.
It wasn't something you wanted to aspire to be when you grew up, you know?
There's a story you tell in the book about, I think it was Thanksgiving.
Yeah, Thanksgiving. Yes, Thanksgiving, and walking by and seeing, you know, the women talking in Dad's rooms and then going to the table for Thanksgiving, sitting down and saying, Dad, the whores need to be paid.
So, oh, my God.
What an all-American moment that was,
it
huh?
It was. There's a lot of those in the Pryor household, to tell you the truth.
Wow. Yeah. It's the Paul Harris Show, sitting in the studio today with Rain Pryor, Richard Pryor's daughter, who's written a book called Jokes My Father Never Taught Me. There is, of course, a link to it on my website, harrisonline.com. Takes you to where you can buy it on Amazon, and we're just looking at the page there. It is now number 6,625 in the book list.
Wow. It's gone down from like 17,000, so that's good.
Yeah.
Someone's buying it.
You're moving up a couple of notches.
That's right.
6,625 with a bullet.
Oh, wow.
I shouldn't say that in your family.
That could mean something.
Could be a car engine with a bullet. people who are buying your book are also buying books by Sharon Osbourne, her autobiography, Denzel Washington, Tavis Smiley, and Redneck Woman by Gretchen Wilson.
Yeah, that's the one that baffles me right there.
We don't quite know how the crossover is there,
but
it is nonetheless.
Yes.
We were talking a moment ago before the break about you knowing when your dad was a comedian and going to see 3,000 people laughing at him and that sort of stuff. I was surprised in the book to find out that when he started out, he wanted to be Bill Cosby.
Yeah, absolutely. Because at the time, that's who was big, and that's what everyone, too, around you is like, oh, if you want to make it, you got to be like Bill Cosby.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the people, you know, I mean, that was the inspiration back then. Bill Cosby, the Buster Keatons, you know, the Bob Hopes. It was that's what was there. So, yeah, that's what he started off doing and being, but also inside had this other voice going on that sort of wanted to emerge and come out.
So in those early appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show and other 60s TV shows, he was doing a Cosby-like act.
Absolutely.
But inside was kind of torn that he didn't want to do that?
Absolutely. Just like Eddie Murphy was doing a Richard Pryor kind of act when he was doing Raw. But, hey, do we talk about that? No. So,
We're going to talk about that in just a second here.
Now
but I just want to finish this one thought. I actually had that written down as one of the things I wanted to ask you about here.
Yes.
But at what point did he realize, you know what, I've got to take... Because I think George Carlin went through something similar, you know?
I think many comedians did, because that's what, you know, I mean, you follow what was on TV anyway, you know, and that's what was commercialized, and you want to be commercial because you want to make it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think inside you have an inner voice that is screaming at you, and for my dad, it was screaming, began to scream very loudly, and especially after he went to Berkeley and met with the Black Panther Party, and also... being with someone who was like my mom, who was also very politicized and said, be who you are, be the Black man that you are, powerful, and use that voice. And, you know, being on stage at the Aladdin, staring at the audience and realized, I can't do this anymore, and walked off. And that's when he became, defining moment, became Richard Pryor as we know him.
And what did he change into? And how quickly did he change into that?
I think what he changed into was just allowing his truth, not being afraid to have that vulnerability and going to that edge, especially politically and what was going on in the environment. And I think that's what I think we're missing in a lot of our comedians today is everyone's so into being politically correct,
mm-hmm.
that we're not willing to say something that really matters, that affects us and then makes us laugh, you know, and we're also not willing to be vulnerable anymore. Everything has to be kind of secretive,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So, you know, it's funny because having seen some of your dad stand up in those black and white days in my house,
right,
anyway,
right.
Before we got a color TV in the 60s, when he would be doing the suit and tie act, I called
right,
it.
Right, absolutely.
And much like Carlin, but Pryor would come out there and he would do this suit and tie act, and it was just okay.
Right.
But later on, I actually think he became more like Bill Cosby in one very important way, which is while Bill Cosby would never do Richard Pryor material,
right,
and Richard Pryor could never do Bill Cosby material,
right.
They both built their shows on being great storytellers.
Absolutely.
It wasn't,
absolutely.
I'm going to do a setup, I'm going to do a punchline. I'm going to do a, it wasn't that standard old
right.
stand-up comedian.
Right, it was storytelling.
And it was all from his own experiences.
Absolutely. And then again, that's why we loved him so much. I mean, I think we related to his story and he brought us into his life. And we love when people do that. I mean, I think many artists forget that. What we love is your vulnerability and your honesty. You know, it's the other stuff that we kind of just... You know, we shun off.
Yeah, when you're talking about your own experiences, that's great. When you're talking about other people's experiences
right.
and faking it, it's very easy to see through that from here.
Absolutely.
Very clearly.
Absolutely.
So now let's talk about people who've ripped off Richard Pryor and didn't do their own
the
lives.
The list is long.
Yes,
so,
it is.
But you know, Milton Berle ripped off people for years, too. And so,
but he was ripping off jokes.
Yes.
People like Eddie Murphy and others.
Well, I think it's an admiration. I mean, I think these people really admired my father, and just like my father doing Bill Cosby, figured, you know, I'll do Richard Pryor, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, so on and so forth, and you continue on that path.
You think it was a matter of them having to find their own voices, but in the meantime, stealing his?
Absolutely. You know, and also, too, I don't, you know, even today's comedians, I still don't think are too afraid, and especially, you know, I think Chris Rock kind of goes there, but could even go farther if that's what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just think politically and worldly, there's just so much more risk that we can take if we're willing to
do it. You think they're holding back because they don't want to offend?
Absolutely. You know, nobody wants to offend anymore. You know, I mean, God bless, you know, Tom Cruise jumps on a couch and we all go awry. So how do we expect a comedian to go out there and say something real without us going awry?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We're just waiting for the spaceship to come down.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Later on, I'm going to be talking to our TV guy, Aaron Barnhart, about the first season of Saturday Night Live, which just came out. And your dad famously appeared on that.
Oh, which is brilliant. My mom's on that, too, I believe.
Is she really?
Yeah, my mom my mom was on that episode. She did a poetry thing. There's pictures of the family on there as well. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
The show that he did was the first one they ever had to put on the 7-second delay.
Yeah, right.
Now everything, including this show.
Right, is on 7-second delay.
I think we're actually on 2 7-second delays back to back because the company's so nervous about that and times are different. And we started this whole conversation a half hour ago talking about the N-word.
Absolutely.
And your dad and Chevy Chase did that classic routine.
Right. But see, that's brilliance. I mean, that's such brilliance. And I think even to show that, I think they should air that even now, especially after the whole Michael Richards thing.
Yes.
Because I just think that's what we're talking about. That's the poignancy of the word and why it's so to people.
And I find it so sad that we have devolved. It's been 31 years since that aired on television, and we now are at a point where if you put that on television, you'd have to bleep that.
I know.
It's
amazing.
It was on a 7-second delay, but essentially live in those days, and no one went, call NBC, get that off the air.
Right, right.
But very, very different.
Yeah.
Your dad liked doing TV.
Absolutely.
And actually had his own TV show for about a minute and a half on NBC.
Yes, until he came out naked. So, you know, yeah, I mean, that'll...
Now you got to explain that for people who may not know the story. 1980, right?
Yeah, I believe it was 19. Was it 19 or before that?
Maybe 79, somewhere around there.
Yeah. And it was his show, and he had this idea that he would come out and, but I think it was a bodysuit actually, but the idea was to come out naked or something like that. And obviously censorship, black man naked. And, you know.
I don't think a white man could have done it either.
Well, you know, in those days, maybe, but.
Maybe. I think the point was that he was doing the show, and the NBC censors had cut other stuff that he had done.
Right.
And so he went out there, and it was the show, look, they've even cut off my genitalia, was the idea in that bodysuit.
Well, you know more than I do on that, so that's good. Yeah, thanks.
And then
no, really.
At what point did you get the TV show head of the class?
I got in 1988.
Late 80s,
Late 80s.
Yeah, and you weren't a part of the original cast. You came in, what, the third season, How'd you get the show?
I just, you know, I went for a general audition, which is like you go and you're supposed to meet a casting director, that's basically, and bring a monologue. And I wrote my monologue, and it was three characters, and I did the three characters, and then afterwards they said...
Well, let me just stop you right there before we get to what they said. You're auditioning for a sitcom to play a certain character, and they tell you, bring in other characters?
It wasn't for a certain character. It was just to go to meet them because they were looking for potential new characters.
I see.
So I went in with a three-person monologue and did it, and then afterwards they said, well, do you have any teenagers? And I said, sure. And they go, well, can you bring it in tomorrow? And I sure means no, but I went home, read the newspaper, found this great article, and decided I would base my character on what was in the article, and then went back in with this tough teenage talking, rap talking chick, and they said, oh, we'd like to use that character on the show, and with you doing it, and that was it.
So you created your own character for that show, and you did it in less than 24 hours.
Yes.
Why do they need writers?
Because Rain can't write episodes, that's for sure.
And did you like doing a sitcom?
I loved it. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was. I love live audiences. So the taping parts to me, that's very boring to me.
Mm-hmm.
But once on Friday nights and then you're doing it in front of a live audience, I love the theater aspect. And to me, that was just brilliant.
And you did it. Howard Hessman was still there at the time, right?
Yes. Yeah. And then he had left and Billy Connolly
came in. Yeah. How's that? And when a major cast member leaves and now.
You know, I don't think I was aware or really noticed. I mean, that's the truth. I think I just went with the flow. I'm like, oh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I didn't even know TV series end and then you can be broke. So that was. That was a whole other concept in and of itself.
Obviously,
too.
Never worked in radio. Happens all the time.
Yeah.
Is that what happened to you? The head of the class, you were out 2 or 3 years, and then
2 or 3 years, and then they were like, "Okay, we're canceling." You're like, oh, "But I bought a house."
Mm-hmm.
They're like, yeah, we know.
And are you then sitting in your house expecting the phone to ring? Hello, miss, I was on head of the class. We'd like
if
you to do
then,
this.
By then, you still have a phone. And
So what happened after that?
You know, so after that, I sort of did a couple of plays and then sort of fell off the radar for a while and wasn't sure if I really wanted to act. And then went into counseling, actually. I went to go to counseling. I became a counselor. Decided to counsel others.
Uh-huh.
And then and that's when I started getting back into acting. Ended up on another series playing a drug addict, which I thought was really funny, a lipstick lesbian heroin addict. And went on knowing my character was to die. So I did that. And then afterwards sort of went back to counseling again and then developed my show, and that was it.
And how was your relationship with your dad in the last few years when he had MS?
Amazing.
Did that bring you closer?
You know, when my dad was diagnosed in 86, I had been living there, and so our relationship was already close. But I think what happened was a healing process began back in 1986, which was the, you know, us being able to talk on a different level because life was slowing down for him. And with that, you know, obviously brings up great opportunity to either hate each other or to come and love each other. And I think what happened was we came to really love each other. And so by the time he passed away, I really felt that the truest man I've ever fully given my heart to, you know, was gone. It was very difficult.
It is so odd for me to hear you talk about him in those terms and to read what you write about him, which are also in those terms, knowing that there was a time in your life when this was the man who was beating you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think in life, I think you have to understand, you know, you only get one parent and they're doing the best they can from the circumstances. When you understand the psychology of your parents, he was doing the best he knew how to do from how he was raised and what surrounded him. And no one around him was telling him no ever, you know.
Boy, that's for sure.
And so, right. And so for me, it was like, okay, do I love this man or do I hate him for the rest of my life? And then, God forbid, he should die. And then I'm living with that kind of hatred and anger. And what I decided to do was look at him, analyze him, sort of accept it and go, he's not going to be the dad I want him to be, but he is my dad. You know, and that was it. And love him regardless. And then hopefully with myself, move on with my life,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a more positive arena.
This book must have been therapeutic for you in a way.
I think now it is. It's funny writing it. I didn't really see it because I was grieving while I was writing it, basically. But I think now, hindsight, it has been therapeutic because it really makes me look at my life and understand some of the choices and things in it. And again, you know, I'm proud of myself because I really had, I have every excuse to be a screw up, every excuse, according to that, in that book, that, you know, of my childhood, to really be someone who is messed up in their life. And I choose not to be, you know, I don't think that's an excuse, actually.
Rain's book is called Jokes My Father Never Taught Me, The Love and Loss with Richard Pryor. It's a pleasure meeting
you. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Paul.
Thank you so much for coming in. Rain Pryor here on The Paul Harris Show. It's